Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Eat, Drink, and Be Literary. I'm Joe Melillo, the executive producer here at BAM, and on behalf of my professional partner, Karen Brooks Hopkins, and all of our sponsors and the National Book Awards Foundation, I want to welcome you to this evening. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce to you our great partner, Leslie Shipman, Director of Programs of the National Book Foundation. Please, welcome Leslie.
Hi, everybody, and welcome, and thank you, Joe, and everyone at BAM. I'm really honored to be here tonight introducing Dan Menneker and Jimmy Breslin, especially whose books and columns have long instructed us in ways to write and think about New York City. It's really a pleasure to have Jimmy here. But I want to talk about Dan briefly. Dan's going to introduce Jimmy, and this is Dan's last night with us. He's done two other events, Nathan Englander and Art Spiegelman, and they were fantastic. So I just want to thank Dan for sharing his editorial insights, great questions, and quick follow-ups, and we'll look forward to more of that tonight. Just a little bit about Dan. He began his 26-year career at The New Yorker as a fact checker and spent many years as executive editor of Random House and also editor-in-chief and at HarperCollins as well. He's an author. He has two books of short stories and a novel called The Treatment, which was made into a film. So please, thank you. Help me welcome Dan Menneker.
What's your phone number? The person who gave the applause. That was good. Terrific. Just a couple of sort of procedural notes. I will introduce Mr. Breslin with great pleasure. And then he'll read for 15, 20 minutes. Then, as before, and those of you who've been here before know the drill, we'll talk together for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then there'll be a Q&A with you all. And then Mr. Breslin will, and I'm sure he recoils at being called Mr. Breslin. I don't know what else to do. So he will be signing his books, especially the newest book, The Good Rat, which is what we'll be principally discussing this evening after I think he reads from it. So I'm going to, this is a tough introduction for reasons that will become clear. You have on your programs a kind of introduction to Jimmy Breslin, his work and his career. Jimmy Breslin was born in Jamaica, Queens. He was a columnist. His sister Deirdre, who's sitting with us, told me that he started writing practically in kindergarten and was interested in journalism and being a journalist from the very beginning of his life. But he became then one of the voices of New York that was loudest and clearest for the Herald Tribune, then for New York Magazine, ultimately for Newsday. He retired officially from Newsday in 2004, but still contributes. He is the recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, the George Polk Award, many other accolades, many other awards and recognitions. It's hard By the way, as you may recall, some of you who have the same hair coloration that I have, he ran for city council president with Norman Mailer running for mayor on the absolutely unassailably excellent platform of New York City seceding from the state, giving us a kind of civic pride at a time that we really needed it that was most welcome, I have to say. But now I have to read this. It's very hard to introduce a man who writes, as Jimmy Breslin does, on page 127 of an earlier nonfiction book, I Want to Thank My Brain for Remembering Me, about the harrowing neurosurgery he underwent. This is what he said, quote, "I cannot stand compliments. What am I going to do? What do you do?" So I guess that means I can't say a number of things that I would have liked to say. I can't say that he writes with a voice so original and so muscular that it's like a physical presence in the room when you're reading. I can't say that he has been utterly fearless and honest in his journalism. I can't say that he has set down the lives of so-called ordinary people with dignity and respect. I can't say that he has one of the drollest senses of humor ever set down on a page. And I can't say that it's impossible for me, as a native New Yorker myself, to imagine this city without Jimmy Breslin. Here he is.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for being here. I'm familiar with the area here. We used to go into a bar here, Johnny Bananas, his friend. He did right on Lafayette, he had it. And it was the one most underrated name in writing in the city of New York, a man named Tony Betts. He worked on the New York Daily Mirror, and he covered the racing. That's all he wanted to know about. And his humor, he had humor that you didn't have. He did a book, Betts Across the Board, which, if you look at it, they say it was just a fellow around a racetrack. It had adult humor, an adult perspective, and it was fun. And I was just sitting here remembering. Today, they put fearsome headlines about people being dispossessed and thrown out. They couldn't pay their mortgages. He always made his living writing about them. You go past the family sitting out on the sidewalk on their couches, and you say, well, what have you got here, an outdoor cafe? And a woman says, no, the marshal just threw us out. And that was, as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking of that. I am here because of recent work, and it started when I went to a funeral of a soldier who was killed in Iraq, and it was at the St. Francis of Assisi Church on Featherbed Lane in the South Bronx, And at the funeral, there was a rainstorm, and they had the casket in the center, and then after, a general got up and spoke, and after it, everybody walked out, they went outside, and a slim little girl, Latino, came out. She was in a short coat, and the rain immediately streaked it black. It was a heavy rain. She still stood there and waited for that general. And when he came out, she said, I want to ask you a question. He said, oh, my dear, yes. He was so proud, happy to condescend and talk to this little girl. And she just looked at him and said, I want to know why my boyfriend is dead. And the guy went back as if he had a bullet had gone through him. And I just looked at her and said, all that guts and all that hope and all that love gone. And I said, I'm going to follow around. I'm going to wind up writing a novel about that. I love it. So then I'm in, one day in New York, in Manhattan, and they said that the HarperCollins wants to know, would you write this book? The editor was there, a book about, you had two mafia cops here for trial, right up here on Court Street for two cops. They were detectives, and they were having murders for the mafia. So I said, yes. Always in my life, when I say yes, I mean no. I'm not gonna do a book about it. But then there was enough pressure on me. I had to show up at court opening day for the trial. And I'm out in the hallway, and I meet the two detectives. They were still out at the time, not in. And one was named Caracappa and the other Eppolito. And I spoke to them. Eppolito reminded me of a long day we spent in a bar on 3rd Avenue. That never happened. I listened. I spoke to the other one, Caracappa. And I didn't like either of them, and I knew I was going to go in and sit down, pretend that I'm interested, and then go out to the phone and get out of this thing. And that's all there is to it. Then I went in and sat down, and it started. And I'll read it just exactly. The door opened, and here's this guy come out with glasses, business suit, mild face, and he sat down. And they go to him, what is your name? Burton Kaplan. So I said, what the hell is this? Is it a mafia trial? They're bringing a guy in here. I thought he beat a stenographer or something. What is he doing here? So he said, how old are you, sir? And he says, I'm 72. Are you currently incarcerated? Yes. He says, I would like to ask you to pick out the two detectives. He did that. Now, can you tell the jury how long you've been incarcerated? Well, this is my second or third time. He was trying to remember. And he said, what were you in for? What was your problem? And he said, well, I had the two detectives, Mr. Eppolito, Mr. Caracappa, and we did things together. What did you do? Murder? And what was your role in it? I paid them. And that started I started to look at the guy, and I said, I never saw a thing like this in my life. This guy is horrendous. And they said, what crimes have you committed in your life? And it's a long paragraph. I'll just tell you. He started arson. He started with an A. Arson, assault, kidnapping. Then he went into it, murder, hijacking. That was he said that a couple of times. He loved that word, hijacking, selling goods. And they said, did you ever commit a crime other than that? In prison, I did. And he said, what happened? He said, well, I was assaulted in Lewisburg Prison, where they sent me, in Pennsylvania. I was assaulted, so I paid a Mexican $1,500 to assault the guy back. And he assaulted him pretty good, too, he told the court. And that was his start of a long... He went into a long discourse about he grew up here on Vanderbilt Avenue in Brooklyn, and he went to Brooklyn Tech High School. That's one of the world's best high schools, right? What did you do? He said, I stayed there 2 years. And then he looked around. He says, you know, I should have stood there. That was his thing. So what made you leave? He said, well, there was a chance we stole a truckload of goods, and we opened the store. We just took an empty store and put pipe racks in there and sold them right off the rack and made good money at it. And it was good. It was stolen, swag, and I liked the word, and we did more. And it kept on until I got caught. Now, with the murders, however, it was a different story. He was a fan of crime. He went to the 19th hole. You know where that was? By Tiger Heights? And he'd stand outside and look at all the guys inside. There had a lot of wise guys hung out there, to my knowledge. And he met Gas Pipe Queso there. So they became quite friendly. And then Kaplan felt great. Now he's in with the real thing. And Queso said to him, you know, can we get anybody murdered? Do you know anybody that could do that work? And Kaplan said, yeah, I know a perfect way. We're going to meet a couple of detectives. He had buttered them up and been around with them. So he made a deal with Queso, who was a mafia hoodlum, a killer. But the two detectives had the wherewithal. They had badges and guns. I mean, what more do you want for hitmen? So he made a deal. Queso would give him the money. He'd hire the two guys, and they'd go out and kill. But it was always that they had a way to find the people they wanted to shoot, and which brought a very bad day. There was a Guido, Nicholas Guido, they said he was talking too much, and we have to get rid of him. That's on these pages here. Let me do it from memory, huh? So he said... They went to Caracappa was good at the records. He went to the police headquarters. You turn in a sheet of paper for the people you're looking for, the person you're looking for. They take it back into their computer sections, and they run it through, and they finally can come up with a name. So he gave them the name Nicholas Guido, and he went and sat down in the hallway of the police identification bureau. He sits under a big picture of John Dillinger, they have posted there. Make you feel at home while you're there. And the guy came back with two Nicholas Guidos. One was a known criminal upstate, and the other was a Nicholas Guido on 17th Street in Park Slope. No record, no record at all. But they, Harry Kappa, the detective, decided that's the guy. He's right in the neighborhood. So they went there, and Nicholas Guido happened to be a young man whose dream in life was to pass the civil service test for the Department of Sanitation and have a job. He was working as an errand boy around Brooklyn, and he did some work for a phone company. He wasn't the swiftest person in the world, but he was loved by everyone, particularly the way he cared for his mother. And he played on a saloon softball team and was around, and he got a car. Finally, his biggest thing, he saved money, and he bought a new car. And he had that parked in front of the house on 17th Street, and he took girls in the neighborhood around in the car, which was terrific. And then one night he went out driving alone with a friend, and on the West Side Highway they were met by two tall prostitutes, and he got scared and drove home fast. That was his life. He never was around much. So on this Christmas afternoon, when everybody in the street was cooking or going to each the houses where they were going to eat Christmas dinner, he was there with his uncle and his mother on 17th Street, and he went out to the car to show the uncle, look at the car I have, new car, and he got in with the uncle and was showing him the things, and he just happened to look out, and they're walking up the street right behind them, from a car parked down the street, were two obviously hoodlums. They weren't there for any good. And he got nervous and pushed his uncle down just as the two started to shoot. And the bullets went through Nicky, and he was dead, and the uncle was saved. So he died a hero. But that started it. The fable, the fiction that these people are fun, or that the end of it could be all right, there's nothing to worry about. It wasn't. They killed a lovely young man, and a family grieved, and neighbors became frightened, and the life in New York went down. And these two detectives then went on. They were charged with 8 murders dealing with this gas pipe case. But there were many more, and you had cops doing the shooting. There was one night there was a car left on the grass on the Belt Parkway along the side, and the detective from the precinct went up there and he looked at the car. The guy in the car was dead, slumped over, been shot many times, and he said that wasn't an accident. I mean, no stranger, no hijacker, nobody jumped out on this guy. He was driving along, and then he pulled in. He had to stop for a reason. He knew who he was talking to people. Nobody did this by accident. And that was how they began to think if a cop could have pulled him over, which they did, and claimed you're speeding, you better get and pull him in, and then shot him. They were doing things like that. And it wound up as they got arrested. There were so many people talking about them that finally the two detectives were arrested, and Burton Kaplan is sitting home, and they came in and lifted him, and he didn't like it at all. I'm a legitimate businessman, he told them. It was an amazing mind. He had a daughter, it's a lovely young woman. She went through Cornell, I guess it was, yes, and he pushed her, and she wound up going to Nassau County and had a job in the justice system there, which produced the big names in this city, Jack Weinstein and Gene Nickerson, and she was working there. Jack English, who gave you Bobby Kennedy, he was the leader. She wound up coming back to Manhattan, and she got involved with a political club and with the Women's State Democratic Women's Committee, and she got nominated for state Supreme Court judgeship, and she ran in an election and won without a word of anything to do with Burton Kaplan. He just sat there. They had one big affair here in somewhere along the shore, and it was her wedding, and there was nobody legitimate there, I guess. I don't think so. He didn't know any legitimate people, Bert. And then she said, I went to see her when I was doing this thing. I go to the court, and she was sitting on the bench, slim, good-looking younger woman. She looked down the aisle. She saw me coming in. And, I mean, I don't move in secrecy, you know, but come in. What's happening, you know? And she sent the court officer back to say, she will not talk to you. Don't worry. And that was that. She's still there. And Burton Kaplan made a deal. They saw him. They went to see him in prison. He was in prison. They made a deal with him to testify against these two detectives. He said he would never do that. I'm no rat, he kept saying. He said, I'm not a made man in the mafia because I'm Jewish, but I'm no rat. So the guy said, well, then you're going to stay the rest of your 20 years in jail. What are you, sick? And you've got a grandchild growing up. You're never going to see him. What is this? On account of these two guys, you're going to sit in jail. So finally, he said to Kaplan, said, leave your number with me. Feldman, the assistant district attorney in Brooklyn, and in federal, Brooklyn federal, and he did receive a phone call from Kaplan, and they had a witness. And his deal was he was going to walk out of the place at the end of the trial, at the end of his testimony, which he got up and gave this testimony. I gave the money, I did this, I did that. Then the day the trial ended, the two detectives are guilty. And as Kaplan, now I've watched him and watched him through the trial. As I told you, I never saw a witness like him. I walked out of the court at noon one day and went over to the diner, and the young woman that worked for Bruce Cutler in the defense attorney's office, she came up to me and she said, what do you think of the witness? And I had been just saying he was out of Dostoevsky. That's all I could think of. That's all he was. And she said, long before I could say what I thought, she said, Raskolnikov, out of Crime and Punishment. And that's what he is. He says, you know, there's a thing in that Crime and Punishment, the greatest writing of understatement you'll ever find, where he takes an axe out and starts hitting the old lady in the doorway of the apartment house. She was a pawn broker for them. I read that 1,000 times, and I'm watching Kaplan, and that's exactly what he was. He spoke in a straight voice, and he admonished the prosecutors. You're wrong, counselor, he would say. Now at the end, he started to write. He bent over when they sat at the table. That's it. You know, time served on this case, bail for the assault case, which we would never try, and he was going to go home. And he bent over, and I said, I can't believe he's showing any emotion that he's going to go back to his life. So I walked around, and I looked at him, and I saw he was writing left-handed. That's why he was bent that way. He's filling out papers to do with his leaving the jailhouse and the courthouse on bond. He wrote all that out, and he put the pen down, stood up. He didn't look left or right or at the judge or anybody. Walked around the table and went out the aisle, up the aisle and out the door. And he was gone. I never saw anybody like him. And I went to Vanderbilt Avenue 2 days later because they have a liquor store there, big liquor store, deep, goes back in, and they live over it, that family. So I went and asked the clerk in the liquor store. They had a intercom the call upstairs and ask if I could speak to Burt Kaplan. And the kid took the phone, he gave it to me. Here's that rasping voice. Now, it could have been the brother, but to me it was Burt Kaplan forever. Why, you lousy bastard, what are you doing here? You get out of here, I'll call a cop. And that was the end of it. And the book is done, and I was I'm back here talking about the paperback, and I'm making my mind up. I'm going to go to sit down alone and with nobody around me and write about this young woman I saw who said, "Why is my boyfriend dead?" It stuck with me. At which point, a guy yells, "Yo, you're my legend." His name was, got out of a car on the Central Park West. His name was Boganovich, the guy from Illinois, the governor. He's 25. I don't know how old he is, but he looks 25 and he acts 25. And I talked to him, and then I called home to say, to tell my wife, I met the guy. I'm gonna have a couple of cups of coffee and see what he wanted. And she said, "Check his hair. I want to know if it's real." So I'm sitting with him in the hotel, and I did. I put my face so close, he got a little nervous, but it was real hair. And then he started to talk, and I said, "Completely nuts." this guy was looking to extort money from the guy, president of the United States, or some scheme. And I was so attracted, there's no way I could leave this guy. No way. So my dream of doing fiction, which I've always loved and had good luck with, that's got to be postponed. I'm going to Illinois Monday. Well, I mean, I don't know much about it. I do know the area and I know the people involved. And it's a wonderful story. It's strange in that the mayor, Daley, his name hasn't been in it once. There is no game without him either. And there were some wonderful people were there and they're all gone. Mike Royko, Studs Terkel, gone. God, they were great figures. Terkel told me about 10 years ago. He said, "We got a state senator here with a sounds like a slave name." He says, "You'll never know it anyway, but he's going to be the president, Barack Obama." I thought it was a joke. The hell did I know? Studs knew then, and he died before it happened. He couldn't see what he had thought of. And that's it. That's where I stand. I'll say one thing for the book. You're not getting stiffed with the book. You're not. It's good. It's a good book. Believe me.
Jimmy Breslin, a great storyteller, obviously, a natural voice. So natural that when you read it on the page, you just can't believe that someone isn't speaking to you and that person is Jimmy Breslin. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of curious about, throughout your career, it's clear to me that you've been fascinated. I mean, this is so obvious that it doesn't need saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, with organized crime.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I prefer to write about them than hedge fund operators.
I could see the straight man I'm going to become. Beyond that, yes, it's funny. Here's the only person that I know who can put Warren Buffett in the same paragraph with Burton Kaplan, the man he was just talking about. What's the comparison there?
Well, Buffett has been going around saying he knows everything, and then the whole world falls down around him, and he stands there. I mean, he knows nothing in the end. Huh? What did he know? Did he know this was happening? No. Did any of them? I mean, I'm looking at things. The guy from General Motors, I mean, he wants to stay in as the head of General Motors. Good. Let them go into the sewer together. I mean, but they're not interesting people. They're preposterous people. And the worst sin and crime of all, they're boring. That's it. That's a felony. That's a major felony.
Now, not to pin you down, is that a worse crime than two cops going out and murdering people? I mean, to be a little...
Well, it's... The two cops going out to murder people is pretty bad. And then you sit and listen to Warren Buffett for 2 hours, and you say, bring back the murders.
You know, this book...
You think I'm wrong? Do you think he's good?
Do I think Warren Buffett's good?
Tell the truth.
I think he's boring, and I'll go along with it.
Well, that's the worst city in the world.
Well,
you
it's
take the whole country down by being boring.
The only reason that you say it's the worst sin in the world is that it's a sin you're incapable of committing.
Well, if you care about other people, you're not going to bore them. You try and be lively.
Do you see any? You know, you read a little bit of the testimony from Burton Kaplan, and in fact, that's a significant portion of the book because it's so riveting. You talked even in your presentation this evening about the distinctiveness of his voice as he was testifying. Mm-hmm. He was very riveting.
Yep.
You know, I couldn't help hearing some of him in you and some of you in him in terms of the subject, verb, and object. Is that sort of...
Wait. Oh, just simple declarative sentences.
Yes, exactly.
Sure. Subject, verb, and object.
But, right.
With the... connecting them so that they move along and form a flow. That's how you write, and that's how he talks.
I almost felt it as if you two were in a kind of cahoots.
Well, he, his education was such. I mean, he did. That's a pretty good high school he went to. He could have gone to more places, but rather than go to MIT, he went to Lewisburg, and that's his life.
A different kind of education.
Yes. Yeah.
So you didn't really answer my very first question. I'm going to try one more. I'm going to try one more time.
Is it
the interest of the mafiosi, the organized crime, that they are interesting people? Is that what drew your attention to them?
I can't explain what draws your attention, but you start to watch or read about it ahead of the other stuff on the page.
Right.
I mean, it's. Interesting. People read it. I read it. I wrote about it.
So it's a fascination. Well,
and I'm not fascinated. I know I could do pretty good with it writing. That was the first thing.
Right.
That's self-interest comes first. Right? They're very bad people. I lived on 13402 101st Avenue, Richmond Hill, running in Ozone Park. John Gotti was on the street corners there. I could pay the rent writing about him.
Right.
I can't, what are you going to do?
No, it's a meal ticket.
It's good. It was good. Somebody said it was good. It got exciting. They bought a book for the movies. Hooray, let's do another.
There are two passages in The Good Rat.
Why is Dostoevsky's the Crime and Punishment, where is that different from a top gangster?
No, it's not.
Not as good. Gangsters aren't as good.
No, because they're not as smart. And that's one of the points that you make.
Not as ferocious either.
No. There are two passages in your book that talk about the state of the mafia today.
Yeah. Go on.
You need to reconcile them. One, it says there will always be a mafia or something like it in any case.
But it won't be Italian.
It won't be Italian. Mm. What will it be?
Well, the Russians, they're bad people.
And then there's another point at which, earlier on, where you say the mafia, at least as it used to be, is no longer.
No.
What happened?
Schools. You want to look at the list of people that went to some of these schools, and there's nobody left. You take St. John's, Iona, Boston College, Georgetown, St. Francis of Loretto, Pennsylvania 5, the 3 or 4 other Catholic colleges, they all went to school. My own daughter I was taking Italian in school in Columbia, and I said to her, there's some words here I'm all stuck on, and you do it for me, translate them. So she came back later, she said, I didn't know a couple of them, but I got them from a lawyer, a young lawyer I know, and he said to tell you his name so you would know it's accurate what he's saying. So I said, what's his name? Joseph Profaci Jr. And he's one of the crack lawyers in the city of New York.
Yet.
I knew my daughter knew him. They ran in those circles, and it wasn't a gangster circle. Right. It was young people going places.
And yet on page 244 in this book, because I've read it chapter, book, and verse, you say there will always be a mafia, or at least organized crime. And I come back to the question, why is it necessary to have such an operation?
Well, where are they going to go after this Wall Street episode is over? I mean, they're essentially dishonest people. They're greedy. They don't care about anything in the world but themselves. They must steal because they don't want to work.
Right.
I mean, what do you call a hedge fund? Work? They don't want to work, and they want to go out and steal. So if you block them and they can't steal on Wall Street, they'll find a way.
You also talk about the jobs that nobody else wants to do.
Oh.
And that seems to be one of the sort of...
Well, I grew up on 101st Avenue. The next house over was Alfred Hansen's, and his father had a crane. And he brought it home every night, parked it in the yard, and went out in the morning to construction jobs. Crane with big buckets and teeth. And the morning light came across the boom and fell on my face while I was asleep, waking up. So I woke up in the morning with the shadow of manual labor on my face. I know one thing. Not I. And I went, that's where the interest in the newspapers came from.
Right. And that's also a point you make about mafiosi. They don't, or organized crime members, they don't really want to do that work.
No. And the crime and the financial is from people don't want to go to work.
Right.
Just thieves.
Tell me, there's a between those two passages, there's a point at which you talk about RICO.
Yeah.
As a turning point.
Yeah.
Well, can you talk a little bit about why that was so important in the lives of these awful people?
The RICO that I know about, I saw, was put in by a guy named Blakey, who was a professor at the University of Notre Dame. He was a small man, and he came to some big convention I was at, and he had a fawning secretary over him. He was coming up with this law that you could wind up going to jail forever for, which made him feel good. And he was aiming it at the mafia, but he aimed it really at American people. That was his dream, was to have everybody in jail. What? And some of the people at Notre Dame on the faculty spoke to me about him. I remember that day saying, this is a mean little man. And he's got this idea, this RICO, racketeering in corruption. Who knows that? Somebody, what it is.
Corrupt organizations.
Corrupt organizations.
Racketeering influence, corrupt.
Corrupt organizations. And you could go away for long, atrocious periods of time under the law. It was if you commit so many...
But for a very minor infraction.
Anything goes as long as you fall in that category, RICO.
So if you ordered a cup of coffee in the company of somebody else.
Trouble. Forget about it. Very bad. And they loved it.
Right. But it did make a difference in terms of breaking the mafia as was once known?
My friend Sari Ali came from Liberty Avenue. That was on Park, and he was in trouble most of his time. And he told me recently he was sentenced by Jack Weinstein here in Brooklyn that he was never allowed to come back to New York again and that he could not even make a 718 area phone call. True. So he went to, he's in the desert in Nevada. He doesn't even go into Las Vegas. He says he's not like the pick me up and I'm through. He sits there and he says, it doesn't matter. He's just reflecting. He says, they took the zip code away from Ozone Park. That's how many people have gone.
Well, I thank you for this wonderful conversation. Yeah. I also want to somewhat belatedly thank, because I was nervous about introducing Jimmy Breslin, thank Leslie for that wonderful introduction, and BAM, and the National Book Foundation. I have to say, this series, for me, has been a great pleasure, but it is a testimony to you guys, to the cultural life of New York, to see so many people here under difficult circumstances economically. Yeah. It's just, it's truly heartwarming.
I'll tell you one thing that went on this last year, and then I'll get off your back. I didn't believe this guy could make it, I swear to you. Barack Obama, I never thought he could make it. I voted for him. I rooted for him. My wife is an old politician in New York. She worked for him. Everybody was everything, rooting feverishly. And then I'm thinking, with a friend of mine, we were talking about it, though. You want to go to Ozone Park and start talking about this guy? Jesus, Christmas. Our Rosedale, which was our favorite spot. They had an organization there, Respect Our American Rights, roar. That was to dynamite where blacks were or something. They all got in trouble. And because once I still remember being in that Rosedale, and the woman is screaming on the sidewalk because they had a busing. They were busing to break up all the schools, busing to end segregation. So she said that my son goes to a school that's 99% minority because it is. So I said, Jesus, the way I learned to count in the same Catholic grammar school your kid went to was that 99% wins. So, and she got furious.
So
he won. I mean, it's a tremendous thing the guy won.
It is. It's an amazing turn of events. And I have to say, I think we owe some of it to the example set by the previous president. If it had not been so abysmal, I don't know if we would have had Barack Obama.
He ought to be on drugs, that guy, huh? Well, wait a minute. He had a thing there with a pretzel stuck in his throat. Bush. I mean, what am I, a sucker? I know something is there, but either whiskey or drugs, the way he stumbled over his words, right. That was clear evidence. You ever the stumbling is definitely from drugs.
You're a man who does not stumble over his words, we need to let the audience.
Well, what's the matter with having an opinion?
No, nothing. It's a fabulous coda to the book about racketeering. I have to tell you, it's just perfect. Let's turn to the audience and see what they have to say. Yes, sir, with the very handsome beard.
I never went to the Lion's Head that much. No, that's the funny part of it. It started with I had this book coming out, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. I knew it was going to do good. So I met Jack Newfield, was around, and he said, I just was on the radio. And I said that you and Norm are going to run in the election race. I never even thought of it. And then Norman says, yeah, we'll do it on the phone. He got, he was curious and excited. And we had about 40 drinks and had Newfield call the AP and tell them we're running. And he did. And that's what happened. Then what we did was at the New York Post, they wouldn't run a line about us, and Norma was getting miffed. That was his past, and they wouldn't do anything. So Newfield got, we had a lot of young people running around because they really didn't like whoever was the mayor there, Beam had to be 1,000, So they got these young kids to go out with Chalk, and they went on her apartment, Dorothy Schiff, the publisher of the Post, to say that Dorothy Schiff is a lousy lay. Signed Adam Clayton Powell Sr. and Jr. Now, that was up for about a half hour. And she called. She wanted to see us right away. I'll have people there and we'll write a story. Big thing. So I said, that's extortion, but we'll do it. So we went there, and Norman, it was a cute fella. He was an engineering student at Harvard. They didn't know that. And he had a plan for a monorail around Manhattan Island, which cost it out better than they could. They hired some engineers to look at it. They couldn't, it was costed out perfect. The idea was great. It still is great. They never did it. It would have done a lot for Manhattan. So they were shocked. But they didn't know how to deal with it from then on. It was good. The book sold through the roof because of the publicity.
Next. That was it. Anyone else? Can I get a question over on this side? Or yes, sir.
The question
which I think I understand, yeah. and it's one that I actually am very curious to. Okay. How can you be a good storyteller and a gregarious person and then go shut yourself up in a room for a long time and write a book?
Rent. I like novels best. I had a wonderful time with them. I had the World Without Ending Men. I had table money, and it was going good. Then we had illness at home. And you can develop a character, if you don't have much on your mind. You need plenty of just go ahead and do it and not much else. And when you have illness in the house, it gets too, it's turmoil. And I went back to writing columns then. It was easier to write a column than to sit down and move a character in your novel the next few yards. Very hard.
Question's well taken, because you do thrive on company on the one hand, but you also know how to shut yourself into a room.
Absolutely. You've got to work.
You've got to do it. Must. Yes, ma'am, in front.
Yes. 51 President Street in the basement. The building isn't there anymore. They knocked it all down, and they have lovely attached brick two-story houses. Hello. Yes. I don't know what happened to Lion. Everybody, his keepers went to jail, so I guess they had to put him. Pardon me? He was a big lion. I'll tell you what he did with him. Joey Gallo, his name was the gangster. Now, in a restaurant, the Luna restaurant on Mulberry Street, he came in about 3 in the morning with the lion. You walk in him in, and there's a partition there. So he walks the lion this way, and here at tables on the other side of the partition was a young man and his lady friend. And he's sitting here, she's sitting looking at him this way. She got up and excused herself and went to the ladies' room. So he's sitting there just looking straight ahead, and here comes the lion around the corner. Well, he gets up and flees. She comes back from the ladies' room. I was there when the explosion came. And she says, "Where did he go?" To the waiter. He says, "I don't know where he went. He left." She said, "Why, that louse, look at that." He walked out. And she left, too. And Joey Gallo was out on Mulberry Street with the lion. So it was a real lion.
A typical night for Jimmy Breslin. I think we have time for just one more. I want to be fair to the room, and I wish we could keep on with this, but I guess one more question on this side. Anyone? Yes, in the back.
Wait a minute. Royko or here? Royko,
Chicago or New York?
I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. I can barely take care of myself, But there is one thing that has covered our lives for the last 8 or 9 years, and that's this war business. I mean, it is... I don't want to preach, but it does great harm to the American imagination. It does. And you can prove it by the products that we produced at this time. They're down. The humor is not there. When it is, it's forced television humor. It's nothing. There's just no feeling of joy. It's been a horrible thing. This is the 9th year of this thing. And I'm not going to talk. But then, I'm going to stop and I'm not going to preach. But geez, you get this Obama in, and the first thing I read now is we're going to go to Afghanistan. I mean, if you read Kipling, he's got a poem about Afghanistan, and the last stanza of which is chilling. where it says that the British Tommy on the ground wounded, and here come the Afghani women with their knives out to carve him up. And if he should, what he has to do is roll over, pick up his gun, and blow himself away. That was it. If Kipling could see what was coming, what the hell are we doing there? Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was great.
You all right?
Terrific. Again, thank you for coming. Thanks to BAM.
Thank you very much. And you're lovely.
Please join Mr. Breslin for a book signing.